Welcome to the Home Business Podcast with Richard Captain Henderson, publisher of Home Business Magazine, and Sherilyn Colleen, managing editor. This how-to show helps you successfully operate your home-based business.
Greetings and welcome to the Home Business Podcast. I'm Richard Captain Henderson, your skipper at Home Business TV.
And I'm Sherilyn Colleen, your co-host.
Let's secure, foresee, and get underway. The traditional American workplace is rapidly changing, with 41 million independent workers in the U.S. alone. Is it time to hop on the gig bandwagon before it's too late?
But how does a budding home-based entrepreneur, maybe used to the traditional 9-to-5 work model, take the gig leap?
Mary McGuther, author of Thriving in the Gig Economy, is founder of a pioneering firm in the gig arena. She is here to help reveal valuable tips on how to navigate this new gig world of work.
With 25 years of work in peer exchange groups, Marianne has been named chair at CPP Inc., a Silicon Valley staple. Major news for an industry often referred to as a boys' club.
So greetings, Marianne McGuvern. Welcome to the Home Business Podcast. Say hello to our podcast audience.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for coming on our show.
I think you were last on. We were doing just the radio podcast. So we've changed up the format. Hope you like it. And we can never talk enough about the gig work.
So absolutely. Great to see you guys.
It's great to see you too. Sorry. Marianne, let's get started by learning some basics about being a gig freelance worker. What are some essential skills for individuals looking to thrive in the independent gig workforce?
You kept referring to it as the new gig workforce, and I kind of want to correct that before we start, because quite frankly, gigs have been around for a long time. I mean, home business, people have been self-employed for a long time. I think the difference now are there are more ways to sell your services. Now we have technology that has been brought to bear to create a more efficient market of independent workers, whether those independent workers are personal service workers like videographers and electricians and plumbers, or whether they are creative workers, editors, illustrators, photographers, or whether they work in the business domain as, software developers, techs, marketing people, financial people. So now there are marketplaces for all of those that make it easier for people to find clients and have their own services be found.
Maybe you need to call it the new gig economy.
I like that.
So what are some essential skills, kind of getting started here to thrive in the gig workforce?
Well, first, by virtue of the fact that you're offering your service, you have to make sure you actually have some marketable skills. Now, for some people, there is the whole on-demand part of the gig economy. That's, what we think of as the driving services, Uber, Lyft, or the delivery services like Instacart and Grubhub and things like that, where you don't really need skills so much. You need, the ability to drive. Putting that aside, if you want to go into the part of the business where actually you're creating a career of your skills, again, whether you're a handyman or a systems analyst, you have to decide, do you really have marketable skills? And so part of that is going to former colleagues, coworkers, and saying, hey, would you buy this for me? I'm thinking about doing this. Or looking at the sites that provide those sorts of services and saying, could I do those gigs? I mean, so you have to be sort of honest about the fact of, do I really have the skill set that would enable someone to buy this from me?
So, I think what kind of looking back at these different skills analysis, I think you bring up a really good point, because just because of the sheer numbers of things like Uber and some other elements of the gig economy, they tend to get wrapped around the gig axle and what people think about, but it's, you need skills to drive, but that's not what we're talking about. To work in the gig economy, beyond that with skill levels, you need to do an assessment of those and see then if that's something that's marketable.
That's absolutely right. In fact, the whole on-demand space is what I think a lot of people identify only as the gig economy. And that's unfortunate in a lot of ways, not the least of which is this whole issue of the social safety net, where, you know, people are saying, oh, these, you know, these drivers, they don't get benefits because they're independent contractors. It's really unfortunate. But for many of them, for some of them, that is the case. For many of them, they are supplementing another job. You know, I've had a lot of Uber and Lyft drivers who are teachers, for example, who drive during the summertime. So, you know, there is that dimension of the on-demand side that it is like moonlighting of old. You know, people used to always have some extra jobs to bring in extra income. And that's kind of what, in many cases, the on-demand side is. But the true, as you say, the true career gig folks are the ones who are being very entrepreneurial and trying to have this be their living. And most people, depending on what report you read, there's another report that now says 53 million versus the 42 million. Mm-hmm. Those 40 to 50 million people, 70% of them are doing it by choice, and it is their primary form of income. So.
And so you got to have the skills to push that through. Well, you know, working as a freelance gig worker does present some barriers to success that are different than traditional small businesses. Marion, can you name some of the unknown challenges of working in freelance gig work?
Well, I think especially for people who come from an employment background, you know, they've been used to having a boss. They've been used to having sort of the structure. But more important than that, when you're working for someone, your boss says, you know, you're doing X, I want you to do Y, you do it. When you have a contract to do X and your client says do Y, you have to say no. You have to say, sorry, that's not what we contracted for.
They call that mission, in the military, they call that mission creep. So exactly. You want to make sure. I think the problem coming in there is that, you know, they're squeezing in something that's not under the contract. And then, you know, that can be a cost factor and
or timing, all of those things. But, you know, a lot of people are not used to pushing back like that because they're used to doing whatever their boss, quote unquote, says. So that is a new discipline that people have to learn when they start out. There is also the...
Well, just cycling back on that, can't that present some opportunities? That
absolutely.
As long as you're aware of it and you're sensitive and you negotiate with it, it could, you know...
Yeah, we need to start phase two. Yes, exactly. But there is also the managing of the business part that I think a lot of people don't anticipate when they step into it. I mean, you have to bill people. You have to send invoices. I mean, there's a whole ecosystem around the gig worker, if you will, where there are apps for charging time and tracking expenses and being able to send invoices and of course apps to share work and collaborate and things like that. But it is sort of, you have to build your own little infrastructure to be able to manage.
And what I've kind of learned from that, some great points there, is that these apps won't get the work done for you. You know, you still got to sit down and figure out, okay, how do I do this administration? How do I administratively manage the business? And I can't remember how many Saturday mornings I've sat around getting caught up on all that paperwork. And I would see that as a huge challenge as a gig worker. They've got to be aware of that and budget time for that and make that part of your business launch.
Absolutely. And there are some of the platforms, for example, there's one here in San Francisco called Thumbtack, which is all personal service workers. So again, I've gotten my videographer and my gardener and a guy to like find them. I had mice in my house, so we won't go there, but I got like a mouse whisperer from Thumbtack. But Thumbtack also has this viewpoint of these are independent workers and they're great at, you know, tracking mice or making videos. Why should they have to be great at running the business? So they provide tools to what they refer to them as the pros, to the pros in their network, that they can avail themselves of to make that management task easier. So there, again, there are solutions or ways that that can make it easier for the gig workers.
Well, before moving on to our next topic, I'd like to highlight this show's sponsor, Anajet. Start up a fun and profitable decorative printing business with Anajet. Print decorative products on t-shirts, aprons, mouse pads, and other promotional products. A booming industry. Market to companies, schools, clubs, tourists. Anajet provides an easy-to-operate system. Call 855-863-1638 or visit anajet.com/HPM or our podcast website for more information on sponsors.
The way you earn revenue in gig work differs from traditional small businesses. How about pricing? Marianne, how can someone determine their pricing based on skills, expertise, and the nature of their work?
You know, it really is the work that should determine it. And I know a lot of consultants, especially when they're just starting out, they feel that they should have a common price. So they should charge company A the same as they charge company B because that's what's fair. And the truth of the matter is that's not the way it should work.
Right.
You should have differential pricing. You know, if you're doing a project that is very easy that you could do in your sleep, you shouldn't charge as much for that as something where you're actually going to have to stretch and grow. Similarly, there are folks who want to just take, you know, their what they would have earned had they been an employee and, you know, do some division. And that's not quite right. Although there is an interesting rule of thumb, which is the 1% rule. The idea that if this is a role that would cost $100,000 for someone to be employed, then 1% of that would be what would be appropriate per day. So $1,000.
I guess imagine a big part of this is you've got to figure out what the market is for, you know, charging. I guess a lot of gig work traditionally is on a piecework, an hourly basis. You know, what is the market out there, you know, your competitors?
Quite frankly, there are lots of different ways to price. And I actually suggest to people that they should think beyond just an hourly rate. You know, sometimes it's better to bid on the project. So, you know, if somebody wants to have their website redone, you know, you bid that as a project, not by the hour. So that does mean that people who are better at estimating how much the time will take would do better at that kind of work. Another structure that I think is underused are retainers. You know, people do retainers for law firms and accountants. If you're a PR consultant, why can't you do it on retainer? The idea that your client has you for so many hours per month guaranteed. Now, the only thing there is you have to make sure that they don't take advantage of you. So typically with retainer, it should be, there should be a maximum number of hours that encompasses. And so anything
now, typically on a retainer, do you then put the funds that you would receive in some kind of an account that you draw off of? And does that help with invoicing, or would you still be, you know, invoicing the client getting paid that way?
Most retainers are monthly. You'd probably invoice monthly. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you'd have to manage your own funds. Theoretically, they're paying you in a timely way, which quite frankly is another one of the tasks that many people aren't prepared for, is the idea that if your client is late, you have to make the call. You know, you're the brains of the operation, but you're also the accounts payable department too. So, you know, it's unfortunate to have to call a client and say, you owe me money, but it's also unfortunate.
You got to walk that balance of keeping it friendly, but also firm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it doesn't drift off the chart. And the next thing you know, you're upside down. So, you know, I guess there's a lot of different ways to do pricing, and then you've got to take a look at risk. And, you know, I think what you were talking about was a good idea with a, you know, bidding the project, and that's always better for the client with a firm price. You just have to have a pretty good idea of what you're getting into before you give a firm price on something.
Which is a really good point, because quite frankly, a lot of companies don't know what they want. And this is perhaps more true, I think, for the small and growing companies, you know, the startup world. Here I am in sort of startup heaven in Northern California. And a lot of people are kind of gigging everything. So whether or not they actually know what they're asking for is a big question. So one way to bid that is to bid an assessment. So let me do an assessment for you to size the problem. And from that, we'll be able to figure out what pieces make sense to go forward on, because we'll be in better agreement about what the issue that we're trying to solve really is.
That's a good approach. Well, compared to many home-based businesses, gig work can often be more, you know, more isolated, but this can be overcome. Marianne, you know, what are some tips to manage the isolation of working independently?
Well, it is no secret that as this independent work movement has grown and grown, that you see the increased usage of co-working space. So, you know, WeWork has become one of the biggest real estate companies in America, but there are all sorts of co-working spaces. There's a very cool one here in the Bay Area called the Hivory, which is just for women. I did ask them about the discrimination implications of that. We have some male members, but that of course has a cost to it. And you know, they're not that cheap, but they have figured out how to parse their service. So, you know, maybe all you want is a conference room, but part of the reason that people go to places like WeWork or the Hivory or Canopy, which is, you know, another interesting model where they're in suburban areas of cities. So, like, you know, I live in Pacific Heights, not the financial district of San Francisco, and there's a Canopy co-working space two blocks from me, because they figure that, you know, a lot of the boomers who live in that neighborhood don't want to commute downtown and pay $40 for parking. So why not just have it in the neighborhood?
Yeah, that's fascinating. I just want to pull the string on this a little bit. Do you find with, you know, the co-working spaces, is there more of a human nature aspect to this, that people just want to work in a space with other people? Or are they, you know, locating to these spaces to get, you know, office support that they need to run the business? Or is it a combination of both?
I think it's a combination of both, but I think it is more the former. I think it is this notion of, you know, I want to have some social contact. But there are other ways, you know, if you want to avoid that cost, especially maybe starting out, there are other ways to get the social contact, which is to be deliberate and intentional about scheduling lunches, going to events. You know, it is proven sort of psychologically through a, I wish I recall the organizational development person that sort of made this this breakthrough around people finding work, so typically permanent jobs, but it is not your nearest network of friends. It is the fringe people that you meet. So the wider your network is, and the more that you disperse, the better able you are to make the connections that will get you work.
You know, that's a fascinating part of this. By getting out and working in these co-working spaces, you're interacting with, you know, cohorts and potential colleagues and clients that way.
Absolutely. But you also got to go to conferences and seminars, and you have to meet people. Part of me has worries in this world of digital branding, right, where everybody's, you know, tweeting and blogging and putting out their content. And hey, I'm one of those people too. But in the grand scheme of things, it's not like Field of Dreams. I can't just, you know, put it out there and assume business is going to come. You have to still go to places where potential clients and colleagues are, and, you know, press the flesh and see.
Yeah, we had that saying in the military: if you're virtual, you're virtual.
There you go. So yeah, it's very important to sort of get out there. And, you know, many people don't like the idea of personal sales.
But everyone's a salesperson.
Everybody's a salesperson. You got to ask for the business, and that might be the downside for some. Psychologically, it's been said that only about 40% of the population is wired, if you will, for independent work, for entrepreneurship. So there you go.
Okay, so now as a gig worker, you will be a distinct type of independent contractor. Marianne, independent contractors versus employees. Why is it crucial to understand the difference?
It's crucial just because there are laws about it. And workers, I think, need to be informed. It's the companies, however, who will be in the most jeopardy if they do something inappropriate. So the idea, unfortunately, it's very ambiguous in our employment laws as to who is a contractor and who's an employee. You'd think it would be pretty easy, but it's not. And there are 20 rules that the IRS uses, but you don't have to use them all, and they don't all apply equally, and it's very subjective, which makes it very hard for companies to plan and for people to plan. So for the overarching guidelines, I think, that people use is that if you are directed and controlled in what you do, you're probably an employee. So people who hire what they think is a contractor need to be careful that, you know, if you hire someone to come in and redo your website, you can't tell them exactly how to do it. You can absolutely approve the direction they're going, but you can't tell them how to do it. You can't tell them that they can't use subcontractors, for example. So there are lots of aspects to it. For the downside for employers would be if they're found to have employed someone who they thought was a contractor, but the regulators deem they're employed, there are very large penalties on that. For individuals, the reason why you have to know is because there are things that you can deduct as a business expense if you're a contractor that you can't as an employee. The easiest one being your travel to your place of work. If you're an employee, that's just a cost, you know.
Yeah, we're talking coming into the gig economy like this and working as an independent contractor. That's what you want to maintain, is that independent contractor status, which enables you to operate it, you know, as a home-based business. But again, that minefield is if you're really actually functioning as an employee, then, you know, that's going to create some problems for the employer with all those withholding taxes and all that should have been collected.
Correct. And again, the things you could deduct as a contractor, you can't deduct as an employee. Actually, I believe the new tax bill takes
away from the
home deduction for independent workers, making actually the cost of a co-working space a little more palatable, because that you can deduct. That's easy to deduct.
Oh.
But you know, one of the big things to maintain your integrity as an independent contractor is the idea that you do offer services to the community at large. So the fact that you have, you know, a website or a brochure, that you have multiple
right.
emails, all of these things go to support the fact that you are indeed an independent contractor. There's one effort that I actually think is brilliant, but I don't know how much traction it has these days, of becoming a certified self-employed designation.
Oh, where, I haven't heard of that before. That's interesting.
Yeah, Gene Zeno, who runs a firm called MBO Partners, which is an employer of independent contractors when they need employers, has put this forward, the idea of someone like the Small Business Administration would oversee the certification process, and the certification process would show that you have multiple clients and that you do offer services right. to the community at large, and it would be a 3-year designation. So with that kind of designation, you could, you know, safely say to your clients, don't worry, I am an independent contractor.
Well, that's a good selling point then too, to bring into that client, that they don't have, you know, take some of the worry off their shoulders.
Yes. In fact, I ended up starting an employment compliance business because I had situations when I was running my company, M Squared, which matched consultants to projects, where there was the one that broke the camel's back, if you will, was a researcher in technology who was going to write a white paper for a big technology company. She was never going to set foot in that company. This was totally, you know, blue sky research of the future of, you know, X, Y, or Z technology. And they were worried that she would be construed as contractor. So they didn't want to, or as an employee. So they didn't want to engage her as a 1099 contractor. And there was just oh my gosh, if my clients can't use my consultants, I have to figure out a way for them to do that. So started a compliance company to allow that to happen.
Find that market and fill it. Well, Marion yep. McGovern, this has been a great discussion on jumping into and thriving in today's gig economy. Do you have any final points you would like to share with our audience?
Well, I think your audience would probably be in total agreement with me on this, but I think one of my real pet peeves is the fact that a lot of people don't honor the choice that people make going into independent work and becoming self-employed. You know, they often view them as, gee, this is just somebody who couldn't get a real job, or, you know, many times when consultants are going into big corporations as part of a team, there's a little caste system there, and they're kind of second-class citizens, and right. that's really inappropriate. I mean, we should celebrate the fact that these people are putting themselves out there, and they are doing this entrepreneurial thing, and this is wonderful and good for them, and we need to, you know, respect that choice and respect them as market makers.
The future.
Definitely. Marion McGovern, thank you for being such a great guest on the Home Business Podcast.
Pleasure to be here. It was fun.
It was. To learn more about Marion McGovern and her book, Thriving in the Gig Economy, visit www.marionmcgovern.com, our podcast website, for more information on guests.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Home Business Podcast. Share your feedback with us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and at our website, homebusinessmag.com.
Visit the website for information on advertising. Subscribe free to our newsletter. Please visit our sponsors. For more information, visit homebusinessmag.com and the Home Business Expo at homebusinessexpo.com.
I'm Richard Captain Henderson saying anchors away.
And I'm Sherilyn Colleen. We'll talk with you soon. Until then,
make it a great home-based biz day.